You're listening to Radio Jazz. I am Midden Breckling, your host. This is a show where I talk to artists about music, feeling, influences, and inspiration. My guest on today's show has been making music for the last 38 years. His debut album, Introducing the Hardline, released in 1987, was a massive success, selling 1 million copies worldwide within 3 days of its release. He has continued to affect people with his powerful voice, his poetic lyrics, and unique sound. He's released 13 studio albums and 4 live albums. And it was recently announced that he will be going on a UK tour in October and November this year. I'm excited because this man is the sound of my youth, the voice in my upbringing, and a shining light in the field of music. So, Sananda Maitreya, welcome to Jazz Bar.
Thank you so much. That was such a wonderful introduction. Do I send a check to you immediately or do I wait until afterwards?
Let's wait and see, how
Okay.
you feel after.
Wonderful welcome. Thank you so much, Meta. I appreciate it. Great privilege to be speaking to the Radio Jazz listeners.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to have you here. I want to say, your music has been a journey. Your personal and artistic path has impacted many people. And the announcement of the tour is great news, right?
Yes, I would say so, because what it is the culmination of, it's not as if we haven't had the opportunity before to go back to England. However, it was just a matter of waiting for a lot of other things to first play themselves out, that I had to be kind of patient if I wanted to return there in the environment that now exists, where they're very much looking forward to us representing everything that we have done so far. And also it's very emotional because I began there professionally. Well, not necessarily professionally. I began in Germany, but as I became known, it was having been birthed through the through Britain. And so it's a very emotional thing for me to go back finally, ready on all levels to face what was such a momentous past, and the place where that past was born.
Yeah. So how are you feeling right now? Because it's next month, right?
Yeah, it's sometimes certainly it's always sooner than you would probably anticipate, but it's just great because I've got everything pretty much ready to go. And again, it's the difficulty, if there it exists a difficulty, isn't really in the execution. It's just in basically preparing yourself for the emotional aspect of what these things involve. It's never so much the music, which is something we've been doing since we were a child, but just the fact that you do increasingly feel a certain responsibility as you mature to make sure that you represent truly what you are and why you are. So all those things that you so kindly said about us, at the end of the day, we just feel like I and people like myself are kind of blessed to carry a certain energy that it's important to share with people, because that's the kind of energy that we people need, to pass around and to have shared when we have people among us who are inspired. And so, when you feel that responsibility, it's the emotional pressure that sometimes you feel to prepare yourself to make sure that you are full of that energy and you are ready to give people what they're there to receive.
And how do you prepare?
It's a process. It's just the fact that, for example, no matter how much experience I have, like I said, I've been performing in front of people in one form or another since I was 4 years old. But there's still a process that you respect, because as you go through it, regardless of how prepared you are, there's always a couple of weeks or perhaps where you just kind of feel uncertain, and you can even kind of get angry or annoyed that, wait, why should I be uncertain? I know what I'm about to do and I know what I'm doing. But it's just honoring the process that understands that there is still a part of an energy field that you are putting together, that you're processing day by day, that you're building day by day. Just as when you are rehearsing your band, you know, when you're rehearsing, it isn't always about the band learning the notes and the music, because they pretty much know that when they get there. It's preparing an energy field that as it builds a mass of energy that when you're presenting it in front of people, they can feel that that energy has been created for them. And so as you go through that day by day as the performer, you also accept that this is very much part of the reason why you exist. So it's as much as anything else, getting yourself, your doubts, all that shit out of the way so that you can just basically be the channel and the conduit that we are, or the bridges that we are, standing from, like, you know, one form of consciousness to another, that when we're inspired, we all feel that connection to that, I guess, that form of consciousness that represents our higher or our better selves or whatever it is. But the point is that part of our responsibility is making sure that we all connect to that. Just as when we go to Mass and have communion, we are communing together as a community to share a common spirit. And it's no different when we go to a concert. We go to a concert for the same basic reason.
Exactly. And I actually want to talk a little bit more about that with you, because when you talk about that, that energy and community, can you talk a little bit about how it all started? Because it has been like 23 years since you have been in UK, right? And you talk about the beginning. But if we rewind the tape and go way back to when you started out, what attracted you to music?
Well, you know, we basically often, I guess, assume that, you know, we know the source of our, you know, we have like, okay, if we are religious minded or religiously acculturated, we say that we come from God, or we say that, you know, the spirit is our father and Mother Earth is our mother. We get our physical selves from Earth, in the matter of Earth. But I'm just here to say that, you know, the spirit that breathes life into us can also be musical. You know, music is also a spirit, and music is also, obviously, our cultures agree, music is a great, great, great spirit. So I feel like a child of the music, that whoever were the two humans responsible for playing their role in initiating my physical body, I feel like the spirit that animated that body was actually the spirit of music. So one of the reasons that I tell people, they ask, why are you so prolific? I don't usually have writing blocks, because I don't see myself as separate from the source of what I'm trying to contact. So instead of being a person who lives by the river and occasionally goes to the river, I simply see myself as a fish that lives inside the river that is music. And so I don't see myself as separate from that, that's what I'm called to, because that's what I am. So for me, it wasn't like what attracted to me to music, simply because I am a product, a project, a child of music itself. So there was nothing that had to call me. It was just, this is what and who you are. This is your purpose. And it is to be this cup, this chalice that is filled with this energy that you pass on to others. It was never something to seriously think about. From the moment I heard the Beatles at the age of two, I knew this is who I am. So it wasn't really some epiphanic moment. It was just listening to the Beatles and going, yup, this is who we are. And from that point, it just became following the truth of that thing that I was.
If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? 'Cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands. If I give my heart to you, I must be sure from the very start that you with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? 'Cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands.
life, because we weren't raised in an environment where popular music was encouraged. So, but I was born in 1962, and I was born in Harlem. By the time I was two, we were living in New Jersey, East Orange, New Jersey, to be exact. And the Beatles were so ubiquitous in the culture, you couldn't avoid them. Everywhere you went, there was the Beatles. So they infused the atmosphere. and you couldn't help but just get caught up in it. And like I said, as a child of music, what they were doing spoke to me in a language that just went, was the essential language of my soul. So it was, nobody had to introduce me to them. The culture was just inundated with Beatle information and Beatle energy. So that's basically what happened.
And did you start singing yourself, or did you play instruments?
I don't really remember one thing more than the other. I do remember a very key moment of my childhood was I tried to run away at home at, I think, 4. And I was just curious. My stepfather had left me in the barbershop across the street from where we lived. And I somehow slipped away. And the first place I remember going was this toy store on the corner of a big thoroughfare. And I remember immediately being drawn to the back of the toy store because the toy store had like a toy drum and a toy xylophone. And I remember that I was mesmerized by just looking at the xylophone and the drum. Until I went to the next place where I guess I was adventuring. But I remember at the age of 4 singing in front of people and being embraced by this huge pair of bosoms, by this very large, impressively breasted woman, which immediately, of course, would have made an impression on a 4-year-old, which again, verify, well, yeah, I probably should be doing this. You know, if I'm getting this kind of acceptance, this type of reaction. But I just remember anything that was musical and I could get my hands on, I was always around it or on it. It was all such a great mystery and attraction to me. So I don't necessarily remember what I might have done more than the other. It was just always around me.
Thank you. drifters, that perhaps your eyes had seen fall short the glory of. It's been set from the soil of a prophet's graveyard. It's been set by the light of your mirror's vanity.
And you remember the way people reacted, but do you also remember the way you felt when you started to sing, or, you know, the feeling in it?
Well, what you start to notice immediately so much isn't the feeling, because when you're doing it as a child, you're not looking for a feeling. It's just what is there, impressed upon you to do. It's your impulse. It's just something you do. You probably later wind up seeking validation from it once you realize that it gives you some kind of validation. And of course, that's especially more important to you if the culture around you is not necessarily otherwise giving you the validation that you would like, or you feel you need to receive. So if you realize you have something where when you press this magic button, people respond to you in a certain way, or you notice the effect it has, the entrancing effect it has on people, well, yeah, you kind of start gravitating towards that more, because you feel you found a way to shortcut getting the attention and validation from people that you might otherwise be lacking in your day-to-day life or your social existence. So you can't help as a child but notice what works or what's kind of giving you that particular attention. But it's also true that not everyone who notices that power is necessarily interested in further utilizing or developing that. So it can also equally turn you in another direction if you don't feel up for that type of responsibility.
You know, the reason why I ask you is because as a child, I played the piano. And mm-hmm. it gave me that comfort, you know, like when I came home from school and I just went to my piano and sat there with all my feelings, you know.
Well, see, I'm skewered in my recollections based on the fact that this was something that I knew I was supposed to be doing with my life. I knew my life was this. Of course, I had brief moments when I wanted to be other things, you know, but ultimately, whereas I would still, as you were saying about playing piano as a child, it's still a discipline I would recommend, you know, people, if they can take up the acoustic guitar or just some piano, because there is certainly nothing quite medicinal like sitting down at a piano and playing yourself to calmness, or just calming yourself back down or bringing yourself back to balance, or picking up an acoustic guitar, which is one of the greatest feelings in the world, and just strumming some chords because of the power that music has to calm the savage spirit. You know, it's a very valuable gift to have. Mm. And there's a reason why acculturated peoples, you know, used to insist that their daughters in particular take some kind of music, because it was also something seen as enriching and ennobling the spirit. So, you know, it was something that was understood could raise us to another level of self-recognition and self-awareness. And this is something that I would still recommend. I mean, I still listen to Beethoven and Mozart a lot, precisely for the uplifting quality that the music has to just, you know, resonate the spirit with something, you know, of a higher quality than just our day-to-day, the day-to-day stuff that we're fed.
You talked about the Beatles before. I want to tell you something, because the first time that I heard you sing, I'll never forget, of course. It was in 1990, and I was sitting in my living room with my mom and dad. We were watching a John Lennon tribute on telly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and my father is a huge Beatles fan, so he forced me, you know, to see this show. And we were watching all these artists playing Lennon songs, and then you came on.
Yeah,
You performed You Got to Hide Your Love Away.
Yes, yes, I do remember that.
You remember that? And I was a kid and I was just blown away. You know, I'd never heard anything like it. Wow. Yeah, and I just remember your voice and your feeling and your power in that song, because I'd only heard the original, right?
Yes, yes.
So that was an eye opener for me. That was, you know, game changer for me. And I was like, wow. I remember I said to my father, who is that? You know? Yeah, that's a funny memory. And you sort of just stuck with me, you know? Yeah. You introduced me to feeling in music for sure, telling stories through, you know, your soul.
Well, again, it was unthinkable when they asked that I would say anything but yes, because, you know, again, there's the Beatles, and then there's, within the Beatles, as you very well know, there's the cult of John and the cult of Paul. And, you know, I remember saying many, many years ago to someone that the Beatles would eventually wind up being seen in kind of biblical, you know, secular biblical terms, because it's kind of like a religion forms around this kind of thing. And just as religions form, then cults within religions start to veer off. And I have said this probably two decades ago, that you will see a cult of John and a cult of Paul, you know, and then there's people like me that just revere them both for their equal value to my own experience and development as a writer. But, you know, the thing about John and Paul is I thought they were such complementary forms of expression to one another, because, you know, one had a more, John had a more angular, tended to have a more angular style of approach, whereas, Paul's approach tended to be, you know, a bit more vertical, whereas, you know, John moved more of a horizontal. The movement was minimal. Only what movement needed to be had was what was there, the way John wrote, like a cat, the way a cat never wastes any move that isn't necessary. Whereas Paul is like more this gregarious dog that's just generous and will jump all over the melody and do as many wonderful things with it as possible. It was just a particular economy of John's genius that really stood out to me, as much as the generosity of Paul's way of writing stood out to me. So their contrast was always something I thought was just very inspired, the way they wrote together, the way they contributed to my own development as an artist and as a writer. So yeah, when I was and I remember being teased by my one of my assistants for having chosen that particular song, because they, you know, always got a kick out of the way I sang the hey, you know, hey. Yeah. But, you know, I also knew that it was kind of John's way of homaging Dylan. So yeah, when he wrote it. So I just had a lot of fun with it. And I just remember that day as being quite momentous in its own way for me, because I also had a chance to meet a few of my other heroes, and it was a very emotional day. And I can also remember a picture that I took, that I have somewhere with me and Sean Lennon.
Yeah.
Where you kind of, you know, it looks like I'm his proud father. And I was really moved by that picture last time I saw it, because it had been many years since I had seen it. And it's as if he was my son in the picture. And so it was just a great day. And I'm glad that it meant something to you.
Absolutely.
But it's funny, because when you mentioned being young, it reminded me for a second. I remember being in the Netherlands, quite a few years ago, maybe some point in the mid late 90s. And I was signing some albums or some autographs. There was this line. And so as I was signing something previous and they were marching off, this young lady came to the front of the line and she handed me her album. And she said, I want you to know that you gave me my first sexual experience when I was 12 years old. And you should have seen the look on my face. It's like, oh my, wow. I was I was stuttering even before I could get words out of my mouth. She saw the look of panic on my face, and then she started laughing, and she said, no, no, no. I was sitting in front of the television with my mother, and you came on television, and that was the first time I had kind of felt a sexual feeling. And you could see the relief on my face, like 25 years just fell off my face, you know, probably. And even the people behind her in the line started laughing because it just sounded like the perfect setup. Like I just started panicking. Oh my God, oh my God. I don't do that. That's not me. That doesn't sound like me. You know?
Kissing like a bandit, stealing time underneath the sycamore tree. Cupid by the Austin Valentine's to my sweet lover. Slowly, but surely, your appetite is more than I knew. Sweetly, softly, I'm falling in love with you. Wish me love for wishing well, to kiss and tell. Me love a wishing well, to kiss and tell her wishing well, a crocodile she sang.
I'm glad your story didn't turn out like that, because that was kind of like, I've already had that panic before. But, you know, Meta, I remember saying to Miles Davis once, I remember asking him, did he ever stop to think how many people his music put on the earth? And he just looked at me like, you know, like, I don't have time to think about shit like this. But, you know, it just moved me to say, like, you know, and I said to him, between you, for example, and Frank Sinatra alone, you've literally peopled nations worth of population of people who would not be on earth if it wasn't for what your music immediately led to.
Yeah.
So of all the things that we can do, of all the awards that we could be on, trinkets that we may be handed over in our lifetime, there are two things that nothing can beat. And that is someone saying to you, I was conceived to your music, or my parents tell me that it was your music that they were listening to when I was conceived. And that is something that is just so profound, you know, that it's very difficult to process until you take a step back and just realize, well, that's why we're here. We're part of a chain of creation and evolution. And our job is to uplift, inspire.
Mm.
We're inspiring the truth of releasing our anger, our depression, our sadness, our joy, our love. And, you know, and also to have people tell you that I can also remember about a half a year after basically getting slapped around pretty hard for neither fish nor flesh. And I can remember walking into a store on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills because I was looking for a suit that I needed to get because I was invited to some event that I was sartorially unprepared for. So I went into this shop and this gentleman, a salesman, well-dressed salesman, asked if he could have a word with me. I said, of course. And he said, I just want you to know that my partner, my life partner, passed about 6 months ago. It was a very hard experience. But about a year before that, he said he had discovered your song, Billy Don't Fall, and it became our song. And he said after he got diagnosed with his disease, he had to listen to that song every day. He said it was literally the last song he listened to as they were saying goodbye to one another.
Wow. How did that make you feel, getting that?
Well, like I said, I had basically processed a lot of stuff with that project. I got a lot of negative energy initially, a lot. And so, you know, I can even remember an American executive asking, why does he have to write a song about gay people? And because, of course, it was still seen as something controversial at the time. Although I don't remember writing it for any particular political reason. It's just a song that came to me and I accepted it. But how it makes you feel is that after all of the rejection, after all of the initial pain of that process, the validation is something that you can't really put words to.
Mm.
Because then you realize that's why we write songs. Not just to get great reviews. Great reviews, wonderful. But that's not why we do what we do. What we do is to have a role if people need something there in that moment to pick up that's there for them that they feel, yes, this speaks to me. There it is. It's not more complicated than that.
Get up out of your rocking chair, Grandma! Or rather, would you care to dance, Grandmother? Shout it out, let it stay inside. I need you alive.
there is nothing that replaces the validation. You know, the same thing happened for us, fortunately, in Japan, when we found out that there was the leading brain trauma hospital in Japan was using that album because they had discovered that it had an accelerating effect on brain trauma healing. And that completely knocked me for stitches. So again, validation, just by following your muse, just by following your God-given instincts, this is what happens, is you wind up doing what it is you're supposed to be doing in the first place.
Yeah. And when did you start writing? Do you remember that? Your own songs?
I don't really ever remember kind of not writing.
Did you start like writing poetry? I have this feeling.
When I was 15 years old was when I came to realize that not everyone walked around with songs in their head. I was probably 15 when I realized, oh, wait, it's not normal. Not everybody has songs in their head. I always had songs in my head. And I don't feel that was ever an imperative for me to start writing them down until such a time as it felt like that was just the next logical part of the process. And I would say that started happening in my late teens.
Mm. So the melodies came first before lyrics?
I generally tend to hear what you hear. The basic idea that you wind up hearing when you hear my record, that basic structure, including this instrumentation, is what I tend to hear when I hear a song. Occasionally, I will hear a phrase and I might write down a phrase. But generally, even if I hear the phrase first, I will hear it attached to a piece of music that is already suggestive of what it is. Very rarely will I hear a phrase that doesn't already suggest what it is and where it wants to go. But most of when I hear music, I hear music the way you hear it. Doesn't mean that I tend to hear all of the lyrics fully formed, but whatever is the main gist of the lyric basically comes with the basic idea of the song itself. So that's generally how it works. I don't see a skeleton. I see a picture. Though the picture might not be fully formed.
Dearest ones, in the eye of a star, life is brief. A speck of dust from grass to leaf. If on the ascendant your soul arises and doesn't contradict what your essence extemporizes. I've been the hermit and the love thief, and paid for the privilege with tears of grief, which soon my nature circumcises. This song will be brief.
One day in the spring, a question fell and went straight through me. Do bleeding angels sing when close to tears? I need the answer. So if you go before me, would you let me know if you go before me? Would you let me know? One day in the year, a bullet screamed and ripped straight through. I saw the sun begin to bleed a above, a flood of tears and sirens, and our spirits colorblind. So if you go before me, would you let me know? If you go before me, would you let me know?
Do you still play?
Huh?
Do you still play?
Uh-huh. Not really. I'm not that good, you know? It was just because we had a piano in my home.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized when I sat there and played the tones, like, oh, the feeling I got. So my father thought, oh, she needs to take some lessons. And that was not a good idea, you know, because then I lost that, you know, excitement. Because my teacher didn't really get me, I think. So I was like, oh no.
Not everyone benefits from lessons.
No, I didn't.
Because one of my sons was actually turned off by the lessons. Like, I don't want to play piano because people will associate it with that and they'll lose the imagination that says, you know what, you don't need these bitches. Just explore and see what happens. Because if it's in you, it's gonna find a way out and let you know it's in you anyway.
Yeah. But do you like sit down and say to yourself, okay, this is the time now that I have to create, I have to, you know, take my phone and record? Or how do you get it out then?
How do you know when it's time to dream? How do you know when it's time to make love?
Yeah.
When it's time to eat, all of these things just come to you and you go, oh, it's time to eat now. It's not a mystery, none of this. I think it might have been Maestro Freud, of the Sigmund Freuds, that kind of said that, you know, life really is inherently simple. It's us. We people are complicated. And so because of that, we do tend to make things greater adventures than necessarily they need to be. If for no other reason, then we tend to be full of a lot of adventurers who don't necessarily want life be as simple as it is until they're ready to accept that it is as simple as it is. So it's not complicated geometry.
No.
It's just when it's time to do, when it's in Sunday school, when I was a child, we used to sing a song that when the Lord gets ready, you got to move.
But it's true. But it's so, I think it's so exciting to hear about, you know, the process, because when I talk to people, it's so different. You know, the process of creating.
Because Western civilization encourages overthinking. That's by our nature, we try to overthink. And sometimes our cultures get caught up into to show the robustness of our societies.
And yeah.
And our intellectual command, you know, we must kind of create these conundrums where there probably often isn't any. But we're kind of a problem-solving tribe, humans. So we kind of like creating problems so that we can uncreate them. So no harm at all. But it isn't that difficult. I was created for this, as a cup was created to hold liquid. So there, when it's time for it to hold liquid, it holds liquid. It's not anything it needs to think about. When it falls, it falls, and now it's time. And you just know. But I want to backtrack and say something about piano, because if anyone who can afford it, even having a piano in your home, even if no one plays it, even if you just keep pictures on top of it, it's a pretty magical device, and it can help stabilize harmony in your home, period.
Yeah.
So if it's a piece of furniture that you can afford, it's worth it because it has the great advantage of being a psychological and emotional stabilizer, the piano, because even if you're not playing it, it's a box contained of metallic and wooden pieces whose job is to translate vibrations into sound. Even when you don't hear those sounds with the human ear, there is the inner ear that can hear. Even conversation makes those strings vibrate and something happens, even if you can't hear it with the outer ear. So it has a stabilizing influence, and there's no reason not to have a piano in your home if you can have a piano in your home, besides the fact it looks beautiful.
Yeah, I agree.
Her memory, I say to thee, if all I've got is her memory, then I have got all the remedy and the melody that I'll ever need. She to heaven. She loved me, and now I'm flying over the rainbow. Just paint fresh pictures in my mind before you go.
Jazz, and when I talk to people, I realize jazz is so many things. And listening to your music, I believe that you mix all genres together, like you blend the most beautiful parts. Do you think about that when you create, when you have these melodies inside, when you write lyrics?
I don't create those categories. These categories are presented to us by industry for the purpose of marketing music, but also for the purpose of creating the barriers that, I guess divisions is the word I'm trying to avoid using, but just creating the different categories that allows a small percentage of people to exert influence over a much, much larger influence of people. And I say that as neutral observation, not as a negative or a positive thing. You know, this is just the way of society and culture, and it's like this. Jazz, rock, soul, country, these are living energies. You don't tell jazz what jazz is. Jazz tells you. You don't say, well, this is the limits of jazz, because no, that's the limits of your imagination and your acceptance of what makes sense to you, which is fair enough. Nobody has to live by anybody else's definition. But what I'm saying is jazz is a living, breathing, constantly stretching and evolving thing. And so we don't tell jazz what it is. We don't tell country music what it is. If we listen and open our hearts, it is constantly telling us as it evolves, as it grows, as it expands. And all post-millennium rock means is that you don't tell me, you don't tell it, it tells us. And that's just the way of it. Of course, this British tour is the reintroduction for this, for finishing up this year, but next year we're already getting offers for the rest of Europe. So just bear in mind that we're looking to come to you sometime in next year's space, and we're very much looking forward to it.
Wow, that sounds great. Fernanda, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome, Lovie. I appreciate it. And thank you, Radio Jazz.